This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
I will warn you in advance, every now and then I pull this out and look at it. I am not expressing disinterest. I'm usually like looking something up to make sure I don't go, you know. Kurt Russell, was in Spartacus.
No, always looking up.
Yes.
Spellings.
Yeah,
brain farts.
When I was thinking about, I need to know, what's the name of who plays Dave Stoller's mom in Breaking Away? It's Barbara. So I had to look at Barbara Barry.
Barbara Barry.
Amazing. But I like those little things. I was like, I don't want to look.
Well, do you remember? I mean, I'm just going to assume it's like you have the thing going on your beard that it's like, I'm assuming a certain maturity. Mm-hmm. But do you find that like Joe doesn't have this problem? I have like names just go away.
I used to really pride myself on knowing like every.
Yeah.
In character actors, especially like a. For whatever reason, me and my friends, that's like how we one up each other.
Yeah.
And I will say that part of my brain is gaining a little bit.
I have to tell you that as you get older, it becomes a little more elusive.
Yeah. But I've got
a bunch in there, but you know, I used to know the running time of Frankenstein meets the Wolfman.
Right.
I can't remember it now.
Oh, that was one. Yeah, you pulled one out the other day and it was insane. I jokingly said, Joe, what's the running time? And he goes, 83 minutes. And I look it up and it's like,
but these important landmarks tend to somehow, you know, fade into the background.
They do.
When you live your life,
yes.
Watch the hearings and things like that.
I'm not watching.
Don't you want to see Devin Nunes?
What am I going to get out of it?
Do you want to imagine what it would be like to slap him with a 2x4?
I'm perfectly fine being 5 minutes late to the news that either it's going nowhere or that they're dragging him out in chains. It's like, I don't need all the freaking. But as you know, we don't talk specifically about, but you brought something up, and we're always recording.
We're always recording.
Okay. And we haven't even, it's all right. We'll get into introducing you later too, because it's all, but character actors. Yes. It's like you mentioned something that just always just slays me on your show is like there's just such a love for those people, for the, you know, and it's, there's such joy in
they make the fabric of the work, you know.
Yeah, I mean, but and then when you wind them up and give them something really interesting to do and a place to go and a real rich character to develop, it's like they'll just deliver for it.
Yeah, you know? my favorite description of the show, Brent Jennings, who I think he's a lead for us, but he's in his career, he's one of the great character actors, and he said this is a heaven for character actors, and nothing's made me more proud, and I think that's who we like writing for.
Yeah.
Even our kind of our stars in a sense, like Wyatt and Sonya Cassidy. I mean, I think they're going places and have that lead quality, but
they have character actor chops.
Yeah, they do. Like Sonya, I think she can do lots of different things. Has played many different roles. And Wyatt, just the way he carries himself he loves being part of an ensemble. Mm-hmm. And I know that kind of mentality really, I mean, it's fun to work in for sure.
Yeah, so. I can imagine. It's
So folks out there, do you know what show we're talking about?
Yeah, so anyway, well, this is the thing too. We have this conversation constantly.
No, like, they don't. I can guarantee you.
The notion that anybody is just tuning in with no idea who's on is always kind of silly. Just, like, I feel like we could do entire episodes where we just never mention the guest name and people would know.
Yeah.
But no, let's get into it. I had this whole introduction prepped and everything, but.
Oh, go ahead. Forget do it.
No, I don't even remember it. But
see?
We're here with Jim Gavin, the creator of, this is one of the things I love about doing this show is I don't watch a ton of TV, and I'm a real snob about it in the sense, like, I want something that, I don't like using TV as a background noise. I want something that I can really dive into and really love.
Yeah.
And one of the fun things about doing the show is I've been able to, like, reach out to the people who create those shows. Mm-hmm. And there is, you know, if there's a holy trinity for me, I guess, and I hope we've had Bill Hader, who created Barry, on, and Stephen Canals, who created Pose, and now we're with Jim Gavin, the creator of Lodge 49, which probably of those, is like the one you're least likely to have seen, which absolutely sucks because it's a fucking amazing show. It's absolutely beautiful. I'm going to actually, even though we don't talk about your work much, I'm going to force you to try to describe it at one point because it's just this beautiful ensemble piece. I can tell you about it. You know, you've got this great love of character actors. It's about these, you know, interesting disparate group of working class people down in Long Beach who all are part of a vaguely mysterious lodge.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the things I love to tell people about the show is, you know, I've watched two full seasons of it. And I can't say for certain it's not a science fiction show.
Yeah.
Like you could at the last minute, and you did something kind of fun at the last minute of the last one, but it was maybe subjective, maybe not. But you could pull aliens out at the first episode of season three. I'd be like, yeah, sure. That makes sense.
Yeah. No, but, I mean, our show is essentially about a secret society and secret knowledge, and I think that's where it actually exists in the culture itself. Like it's just an unknown thing, hiding in plain sight. Which I have a perverse part of me that enjoys that.
Sure.
And many of the things I love, of the movies I love, shows are things that I feel like I discovered them, that they were overlooked at the time. And I would say we are in that category, and we're weirdly proud of it. At least I am. I'm very new to TV and all this. I write fiction. And
I was just saying to Don in here, it's like, I remember the first time I sort of looked you up, and I got to say, as somebody who has worked for many decades and, you know, there's something really joyful about pulling somebody up on IMDb and seeing basically like one credit, and it's one of the greatest fucking TV shows ever.
If this is it, I will die happy. It's hard for me to put into words how the number of just lucky breaks. I'm deeply aware of how just being able to make this. We're in a phase right now where we got canceled. Everyone's bummed. But this show that it got made at all is a miracle to me. And, you know, Wyatt Russell, who's on the show, he when he first read the script, he loved it so much. And partly because he told everyone, he's like, no one's ever going to make this. Like, who would make it? But we did. So we, you know, I guess the best way to describe the show is just it's set in Long Beach, California, a place I know very well. I grew up in Southern California, and a young man at loose ends who's lost much in his life. Fate brings him to the door of this kind of dusty old lodge, like a mason-like lodge that has its own history and mythology. And he knocks on a door. An older man, played by Brent Jennings, opens it, and he enters this kind of castle, this place. And, you know, it's set in a contemporary time, but we think of it as a modern fable. Ernie, played by Brent Jennings, by day he sells toilets. He's a plumbing salesman. But at night he goes to this place, and he is a luminous knight. He wears a sash and a hat, and there's just a feeling of grandeur, a lost sense of grandeur that these characters who their lives are at loose ends can go to this place and feel something different, feel a refuge. But then there's this larger story that is a mystery tale that, you know, I think we've been cut off. We knew where we were going, but I think for us, the show is about the characters, and I can at least feel good that I think the emotional stories that we wanted to tell in season one and two, we looked at as like two long movies, and I think we completed those. But for me, it's we wanted to make something that you a world you wanted to hang out again and something you wanted to watch again. Yeah. Anything I love, that's the thing. I know you guys talk about that all the time. Is I think it's a show that will reward, you know, multiple viewings.
So if people want to see it, they can find it the first season on Hulu, right?
Right. First season's on Hulu, and the second season will be on Hulu. January 13th, which is a good thing. And all we want is for people to find it. And I'm in this kind of, I've gone through the woes me sad times. I'm just a feeling of gratitude that we got to do it. And I think people will continue to find it. And
I think for sure. And I should say as a viewer, the nice thing too, and I hope, I mean, is there still a chance? Maybe
we are still fighting. To be honest, I think it's a long shot for many reasons. The dread word metrics is being thrown around a lot as a shield. But who knows? I'm not going to, we were still fighting. And yeah. I think hopefully we'll get some good year-end press and make some lists and stuff and can, yeah. But it's been tough.
It's, the problem with a lot of stuff now too, is people, and it makes sense with a show like yours, you know, you wouldn't watch it when it's on. You might be compelled to sort of stockpile them and binge them, which is great for you,
yeah.
meaning the viewer, but yeah. terrible for you, the creators of the show.
It is. And we were on a, we're on AMC that
yeah. Commercials and
live viewing and all that. Yeah. And I'm, you know, like anyone else, I probably takes me a year to catch up, 2 years really, sure. you know, so that's just the way it is now.
I hope it does come back, but I should really emphasize to people, if it does not, or even if you want to do this before, maybe it does, you're not left hanging. Yeah. Each season, by the end of the second season, it's kind of gone to a great place. You yeah. absolutely want to come back for more,
yeah.
but it's not, I don't know, I also think of like Deadwood for years, you know, yeah. we were just fucking hanging there yeah. till we finally got yeah. resolution. But yeah, it's
well, yeah, then you can make the movie. You know, when yeah, exactly. older, or like Twin Peaks: The Return, you can do a whole, you know, different version of it.
We, even honestly,
though everybody's older.
Yeah, and we've been talking about that, and Paul Giamatti is on the show, and one of the producers. He thinks the best version, or he did something in Omaha with Alexander Payne, where he's I forget what it was about. It was a fundraiser for something. But he was on stage talking, and he brought up Alexander Payne. Brought up Lodge 49, and to Paul's great delight, like the crowd kind of yeah. lit up, and we're like, "Dinner Theater in Omaha." That's how yeah. we're gonna finish the story. So who knows? Maybe an audiobook. I don't know, but like we're still fighting. I think you know we have our sets, and that'll be the final thing. So we have those for the moment. So we'll see.
Well, guys,
did you shoot that here?
We shoot in Atlanta. Our stages are in Atlanta, which is crazy. But we do shoot 10 days in Long Beach, and which is great because we really get into the neighborhoods and you know the places. That's the other thing that's I always describe myself as the most spoiled person in this, and that we shoot in neighborhoods where my family's lived. Like, you know, the shitty golf course where me and my dad play, you know, 9 holes. You know,
oh, is that so, your golf course?
Yeah. So
oh, that's fantastic.
I don't know who else gets to be that lucky, but it definitely was like a magic thing that is.
I mean, it's a magical show. It's yeah. funny. It's also, and let's segue into why we're here. I mean, the they do a thing in one of the episodes in the second season where one character has gone into a local bookie and pawn shop, and he's dropped a $5,000 bet, which he cannot possibly meet. It will destroy him because all these people are broke. And it's one of the things I love about the show is they're always talking about their bills like human beings. And, I mean, the entire second season is why we're also trying to figure out how to pay off his hospital bills from an accident he had in the first season. But guy goes in and he drops $5,000 kind of on a feeling. And you know, we're conditioned. We know where this is going to go until his best friend comes in and this act of, in his mind, great sacrifice. Pawns his father's watch to pay off the guy's $5,000 bet so that he won't be on the hook for the $5,000 that he's certainly going to lose. So in other words, guy lays down $5,000. His best friend comes in, gets him off the hook for the $5,000 bet. We know where this is going to go. It only ever goes one place, and it does go there. But what's amazing, and it kind of segues into it doesn't go emotionally where you think it's going to go at all. By the end of the scene where these two characters talking, I just know my wife and I were just reduced to absolute tears. It was just one of those beautiful, and it wasn't just about, they're talking about his father, but it was also about friendship. And it's a beautifully powerful emotional show. And when we were having a little back and forth about coming on, you said you want to tell them what you want to talk about.
And I have no idea where this came from, but I was just thinking, and my idea just was, what movies have made me cry? And specifically, what scenes in those movies that make me cry? And I have no preconceived thoughts, but like, and just I'm curious to throw them out there.
That's
why, you know, I'm sure a lot of it has to do with what I'm going on in my life, but what about it? And why do I remember them so clearly? And they're all fit into that category of movies I've watched a lot. And sometimes I've watched them and I didn't feel it. And then later I actually see what's happening now. And it crushes me. And I don't know. That's why I fell in love with movies is those feelings. Like, and I, this is going to sound a bit rich, but I remember I wrote little, you know, letters to our cast before we started. And I was like, my only goal as a writer is to make people laugh and cry. That's it. Like, you know, and, you know, I think we're a show that tries to do both. I think we can get absolutely ridiculous and, but,
very much so. Yes. But, in the best way.
But I think we have the type of cast that when it's time to punch somebody in the gut, we can do it. And we just want those to feel earned. And I think in the movies I've been thinking of, all those moments, they're not the, – the, it's not where strings are playing. Well, actually one is, and I feel guilty about it. But like it's – they're almost offhand moments that I think suddenly arrested me in some way at some point. So that was my idea. And I just – I'm also just – or get the ball.
Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah. It's great. Give us one. Give
okay.
Us one.
Well, I'll start with, like, a big movie for me as a kid. One, my dad sat me down and said, you need to watch this, when I was probably like 9 or 10, was Breaking Away. Peter Yates, you know, counties versus college kids in Bloomington.
Which is also one of those, there aren't a lot of movies that actually acknowledge class difference, I think. And that's...
And as a kid, when I watched it, I just loved the, you know, this Dave Stoller is obsessed with bike racing, and he wins this big race at the end and beats the college kids. And I just, on some visceral level, I love that. And so I'd watch it for the race. And then, you know, years pass. And when I watched it as an adult and a little, maybe at some point where I was actually trying to write stories and stuff, I mean, the win at the end is great, and it's a great moment. But there's a moment that just absolutely killed me in the midst of Dave. He's kind of at a down point. His mother, you know, is very, you know, this family that's probably never, she's never left Indiana, you know. She's trying to cheer him up, and she says, have I ever shown you this? And she reaches into her purse and she pulls out a passport. And she says, well, I got this. Yeah. And sometimes at the supermarket, when they ask for ID, I like to show them this. And it's just this thing of like, she's someone who's never been anywhere and may never go anywhere, but she went and got this passport. And I had watched the movie probably 20 times before it hit me. And something about it reminded me of my mom, and just like a circumscribed life that has a vision of something bigger. And it just broke my heart. And I remember whenever this viewing was, I just was like, in tears, and also laughing too, that it took me so long to like understand the beauty of that moment. And that's a movie that I think I, you know, create like the balance between humor and all that stuff. It's a lovely movie. So that was one of them.
That's great. Do you know what's the is it Shel Silverstein, the song "The Ballad of Lucy Jordan"?
Oh,
that Marianne Faithfull does a gut-wrenching cover of it. But yeah, it's just about a woman. It's the lines, at the age of 37, she realized she'd never been to Paris with a warm wind in her hair. That song, every time, especially when I hear Marianne Faithfull do it, I just can't stand it.
And I think what kills me, and Barbara Barry is just a mask, like, is it wasn't like, oh, poor me, I've never been anywhere. She, like, there's no sense of entitlement or something lost. It's just, there's almost like a defiance to it. Like, I'm going to dream.
Right.
And I don't know, just killed me.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Let's see. And stop me if you know, there's any of guys who've already dissected these to the...
Well, no, but the great thing is, even if we do go back to the same thing, we're all coming from a very different perspective.
Yeah. So another big one for me, With Nail and I, which is one of my favorite movies. The most simple thing ever, two out of work actors go out of town for the weekend. They go on holiday by mistake, the immortal line. And this is a movie that I watched I probably was in my early 20s, the first time I saw it, and just loved it as a pure comedy. And I'm someone who quotes it incessantly, and it's one of those.
You're amongst friends.
Yeah. And, and for whatever reason, again, I'm too dumb to get the, I needed to mature a little bit before I got the full emotional thing.
The last scene
and kind of the buildup to it. I think now every time I watch it, like I could feel the little tremor in my heart. And I think it starts when, you know, our narrator, he finds out he gets a job. And there's a sense that Withnail is this incredible talent, but it'll never be expressed. He's never going
to. Oh, but there's also some, I tried a while back, I watched it with somebody who had never seen it and was trying to see through their eyes. There's also, because I think it's more than that, you're hoping he is.
Yeah.
But you never quite know until.
Yeah. Is he all talk? He talks a big game. He has a huge sense of entitlement. He thinks he should be revered as a genius, but you don't know. And then the narrator, he's kind of he has more of a working attitude. Like, I'm just hanging around and hoping, and he gets the break.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, he's kind of going off to do this play, and you see Withnail's world begin to crumble.
Yeah.
Who is his friend, who he's in love with, and all these things. And yeah, that starts it. And then like, exactly, you get to see a man, he has it. Yeah. He has it. And he's being expressed. He's giving a soliloquy to wolves in a zoo. It's one of the great endings ever. And at some point it stabbed me in the heart in a way that I still feel now. And I think it's as a document of kind of the creative life for people, the gamble that everyone makes to do any of this.
Well, it's also, I think, wouldn't it be like at a certain point, I don't know, you were probably an adult when you first saw it, right, Joe?
Yeah.
So there's a different.
I'm so old.
I was trying, you know. But I think there's a thing, you know, because I was a much younger person when I first saw it as a kid, I guess. And you don't quite have anything to relate that to in your life yet.
Yeah.
You don't have those people who maybe fell by the wayside who shouldn't have, and you haven't had those.
But that's true of so many books and movies.
Yeah.
You know, that you just,
and then
you don't have the experience to be able to really appreciate what's behind them.
Yep.
You can see them on a surface level and you can enjoy the craft or the, you know, but when it comes right down to being able to say, well, I've had that emotion.
Yeah.
You know, I know what that means. You have to be a little older.
Yeah.
I remember it was not the first or second or third time even I saw that ending just clobbered me.
Yeah. I think there's the experience of sudden feeling that you've lived past your future.
Yeah.
You know, and I think
that's
what Withnail is where he's at. And that movie I watch that at least once a year, and it does, it's like it clears the cobwebs. Kind of reminds me of, like, you know, it makes me want to write, you know, that's a thing,
right? Did you see, this is where I fall. What was the movie last year that Richard E. Grant got nominated for?
The Melissa McCarthy movie.
Yes.
Can I do anything for you? Can I see you?
What?
Please forgive me.
Can you ever forgive me?
Can you ever forgive me? Shut up, little man. I don't know. But did you see that? Or?
I did, and I really loved it.
Because there was that element of, I mean, he was very much channeling some Withnail. And there was just something about, like, I'm normally, you know, the Oscars are nice, and it's, like, fun. Like, I like that movie. It got nominated. But there was something so richly joyful at him getting nominated for that.
Yeah.
Where I was like, he brings back Withnail, and he gets nominated for an Oscar. And it was just, like, this almost personal triumph.
Yeah.
Of us who love that film.
You know what? That one is one of my... I didn't honestly know anything about it. I think I watched a screener.
Right.
And I was like, oh, this is fucking great. And it's one of the rare movies where the depiction of a writer's life actually feels dead on.
Yes.
And Richard E. Grant, I didn't even know he was in it. I was just thrilled when he walked on. So,
yeah. Can You Ever Forgive Me? Is the film. Yeah. Terrible of it. This is what we're talking about. Where you can't remember. Marielle Heller directed. Oh, right. Okay. Who's got the Mr. Rogers film, right? Mm-hmm. Written by Nicole Holofcener. So, pretty serious writer.
Some heavy hitters in there.
But Withnail's just, God, I seriously, if anybody's listening, this has not seen Withnail yet. Just stop now. Go watch it. Come back.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I remember I was at a party in San Francisco and people were talking about movies and, someone I saw, never saw again, said, have you seen Withnail? And I was like, I had no idea what it was. Wow. Right. I saw it at the video store a couple of days later and started there. Ah,
those are the days.
Yeah.
And exactly.
For our younger listeners.
And then the guy who's our music supervisor in Lodge 49 is an old friend, Tom Patterson. He's from London. And when we kind of, it was one of our bonding things, because he's one of those people who's obsessed with it. So
yeah.
It's a rich vein there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I should also, you know, I'm a sap. I'm a sucker, so it doesn't take too much for me. I did bring a list.
I have a thing. Is this a normal, like, I am to it fundamentally, but if it's before 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm the worst sap alive. Like, I will burst into tears at the Powerpuff Girls movie if it plays something the right way, and it's like 10 o'clock in the morning or something. It's insane. There's somehow as the day goes on, I put on my armor and become more cynical.
But, yeah, you know. I don't know. Just
why they invented drinking.
Yeah,
I think it is like that kind of maturing. I would say, like, as a reader and watcher of movies, I think in my 20s, and someone who was imagining themselves as a writer but clearly was not yet, I was more very more intellectual in a certain way. Like, I wanted the big challenge, the big books, the you know, the European movies and all, you know, the all that stuff. And I think it's, I don't know when it happened. I think, you know, around the time I was like 28, 29, my mom died, and, you know, something just kind of shifts. Mm-hmm. And as a writer, I was less interested in showing people what was in my brain than, you know, what was in my heart, to be rich. Absolutely. And I think that's also maybe a lot of the points where these scenes are getting to me is probably after that, where I was like, you had the experience of a loss or something was just more real. That's not the case for all these.
What's the Godard film with Sam Fuller where he?
Pierre Le Fou.
Yeah, where they ask him, like, what's the most important thing in cinema? It's Sam Fuller's day there. He's got the cigar.
In a word, emotion. One word, emotion.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so also on this list, we'll go to Europe. Knights of Cabiria, Fellini, which I would say of this little list, I've probably seen the least amount of times. And I would say that my overall experience of the movie was not like, La Dolce Vita is one of my favorite movies. That's one I've watched over and over. This one is a tougher watch, I think. You know, it's about a prostitute living outside of Rome who her life is just shit. She's constantly getting fucked with and betrayed. And it's done with a kind of a lighter touch in a lot of places. But you're just following her. I think the first time I watched it, I fell asleep. Like, it's a boring... I can say that about many European... Like, they're great, but boring. In some ways.
I want to see that on a poster.
Great, but boring. But I don't know, it has for me like one of the most arresting endings ever, which is you just follow this character to the one last final betrayal, and she's walking, and Fellini just is, he's like pulling her for a long time close up as she's kind of walking away from her latest disaster alone. Mm-hmm. And there's just something she does with her face that is so human and triumphant that even like as someone who is kind of grinding my way through this film, I lost it. Yeah. And I don't know. It's one of the most human, defiant, irrational things. And it's just this actress who I can't remember her name.
Messina.
For the ages, you know, and then, so this one's a little different. I don't know why exactly. It was just a particular, I think this was more about performance and the cinematic quality of it that was just so beautiful that it brought me to tears. And I think La Dolce Vita is a little cooler throughout.
Well, because they're all kind of burned out and above it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this was more just that like gut punch.
I remember having kind of the same. They got restored about 10, 15 years ago. And
I think a number of them have been restored.
Because I remember seeing it actually like in a theater. It was the first time I had seen it. There was a big to-do about the. But she's incredible.
Yeah.
She's incredible.
So that's my, let's see. We have one other, European one. But here's one, Empire of the Sun.
Okay.
Which, I love Spielberg. This might be my favorite one of his. I think the movie that it would, in many ways, you would say if you didn't know any better, maybe he didn't direct it because I don't know. It's something. It has the fewest of his moves.
Yeah.
That, you know, But it's a J.G. Ballard novel, script by Tom Stoppard, a young kid in essentially a, I guess, POW camp in China in World War II. It's based on J.G. Ballard's childhood in many ways. Many reasons. I think it's gorgeously shot, directed, and it has Christian Bale, I think, is one of the great child performances ever. And I don't know why this is a comfort movie for me. Like when I'm feeling kind of lost or whatever, I tend to put
Empire Concentration Camp movie on.
Yeah.
Japanese.
Yeah.
Just Japanese for concentration.
Yeah. Just for a laugh.
Oh, it's so much better.
Yeah.
So much better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Put Schindler on for a couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just,
but that one does. That one is, I mean, Empire has that restraint to it, I think.
Yeah.
But, and obviously that's source material, Tom Stoppard, and a lot of things.
Right. I think they've put the brakes on some of maybe Spielberg's bigger,
his excess,
bigger moves. But it's still epic. I still think it's like an epic war movie. It's epic filmmaking. It's some of the shots are just unforgettable. And I would say the scene I'm thinking about combines everything that's amazing about Spielberg with just a epic, understated performance, and just also my own, where I was personally, whatever. Because a movie I saw as a kid and liked it, because you get to be a kid following Christian Bale around, Jim is his name. But I think Robert Louis Stevenson said something like every kid's greatest wish is to be in mortal danger or something. So whatever, as a kid you watch it, you get to feel that. And as an adult watching it, you know, especially like again, at a period in time after, you know, maybe my mom died or whatever. So I watched it. There's a moment Jim's been in this camp for, you know, over almost a long time, 6 months. He's learning the ropes from John Malkovich's character, who's like a savvy American. And he's just kind of, he has this place wired. He actually is enjoying himself.
Mm-hmm.
He loves the war. It's like this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to him. The key though is that he was separated from his parents about a year before. They had, in a crazy moment, they just got separated and they went one way. He has no idea where they are. So he's been on his own as a 12-year-old. So he's in this camp, and at some point, it's the real, swell in the movie where the American fighters are kind of, the camp is next to a Japanese airstrip base, and they're attacking it. And everyone's running for cover. Jim runs up to the roof because he's obsessed with airplanes, and he knows the shape and silhouette of all the planes, and he's like, it's the thing he wants to see most in the world. And so he runs up on the roof and he's looking at, and it's just this unbelievable, gorgeous shot of this in slow motion, a P-51 going low just at the height of the roofs. And he's there. And the doctor of the camp who sees him up there and runs up to like rescue him. And it's this gorgeous shot. And you can just feel the emotion of this thing he loves passing through his life. And he can actually feel the heat of the plane as it goes past. And so everything combines in this thing. And then it quiets. And I forget what the doctor says. He's like grabs him. He's like, what are you doing? And Jim's just screaming, P-51 Cadillac of the sky. And the doctor's shaking him. It's like, I think he says, like, you can't care so much. Try not to care so much. And she gets quiet for a moment. And then Jim says, I don't remember what my parents look like. Oh, and it's just, you know, it's so fucking earned.
Yeah.
And I don't know, Christian Bale, I don't know how they got him to do it, or he always had it. But it's one of those things where I think when I say have a comfort movie, I think I'm almost looking for a catharsis. I need to like build up to that, to release whatever shit is going on in my head. And so that's a big one. That's a weird one, because my whole family, I remember watching that one together and we all loved it. And then I've watched it at different stages of my life. And I know, I think it's as a war movie, I think it's as good as, you know, anything really, or to me personally.
But, yeah, no, it's a great film. Yeah, it's yeah, Schindler just has those moments that just make me want to shake him sometimes, where just the emotion is so overplayed.
Yeah.
I just always feel like he needs to trust us a little bit more.
Yeah.
To have our reactions.
Yeah. But I think that's what was happening for the most part in Empire of the Sun, which is weird. Yeah,
exactly.
And it's a movie that just seems out of step with him in some ways, but I think is in many ways a masterpiece. So, my goal is not to cry while we were doing this. So I'm doing okay.
We've had one or two. Gurinder Chadha, if you recall,
yes.
Who directed Benedict Beckham and Blinded by the Light.
Oh, wow.
Came on, and I can't remember. We were talking about. What the fuck? You know, Jimmy Stewart, the Christmas movie.
Oh, It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life. Yeah. You know that one.
Yeah.
She just got into it. And actually, we were both crying by the time she was done.
Yeah. Feel free to
don't worry. You won't be the first.
Yeah, feel free to jump in here.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, I'll do one I'm ashamed of.
Oh, good. Fantastic.
Because it's a terrible,
excellent,
ridiculous.
It's a guilty pleasure.
Yeah. Rudy.
Okay.
Fucking people Rudy. Love Rudy.
It's the music.
Is it the music?
It's got a great score.
It is. And I think it's just the end. It's the end when he gets on the field and everyone cheers for him. And it's the most obvious thing. I think I saw it.
Like, you know, the whole movie's going there.
And it just, I saw it, I think, like at the end of in a high school. And I remember watching it alone and just like, I was not given to that type of emotion generally,
right,
that stage. And I don't know why. And I like, then I made my family watch it. They all cried, you know, it was So that's why I'm not going to analyze just, this one as much.
Yeah,
it's
just sometimes
confession.
The mechanism is just doing its job, you know, and it works. And
yeah. It's underdog, whole deal. It's all there. It's all there on the surface.
Absolutely.
And it worked. Just a deeper one as far as sports for me. Hoop Dreams documentary.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, that's.
And specifically, this one was more personal. All I cared about as a kid was basketball. It's all I wanted to do. My dream was to play college basketball. And at some point around age 16, I realized that was not going to happen. But I was a serious.
All right. You wrote one of your stories.
Yeah.
By the way, I didn't even mention. Jim has a book of short story collection called Middlemen.
Yeah.
Which is
wonderful. The first story in that is about a
that's right.
high school player who gets real. Faces reality that his dreams are not going to come true. And so I was a senior in high school when it came out. This is the first movie I ever went by myself to see, which is now something I've always loved to do since.
Right.
But I remember I was working at a gas. I had quit basketball. I was working at a gas station and I got off a shift and I went and it was in an empty theater somewhere in Fullerton. And these kids were living a way different life than I live. But they saw the world exactly as I saw it. Mm. Their dreams, they were only a couple years older than me. Like it was, and I was such a reflection of everything I cared about. It's a brilliant documentary. I think the moment that got me was one of the guys they document who he played at this really good Catholic high school where Isaiah Thomas had played. And when you meet him as a freshman, Isaiah Thomas shows up and says hi to the kids. And you just see the look on his face of like his idol. And then 4 years later, he's so much more like he's had injuries. He's still getting a college scholarship, but like what he cares, he just doesn't care as much anymore. And he knows And they do a flashback, you know, a callback to it. And you see the look, seeing his hero. And then you hear his voice saying, like, because, you know, he grew up in kind of the projects in Chicago and he was this prodigy. And, like, you know, what he says when he's a senior is like, everyone says, hey, don't, hey, man, don't forget about me when you make it. And in this moment, he has, like, at 18, has the wisdom to say, like, but now I feel like, if I don't make it, are you going to forget about me? You know what I mean? And he, just the, like, level of, like, wisdom and everything. And so I was, like, 17, alone in this fucking movie theater, weeping. Yeah, that's another one I've watched all the time. And that, and it was a great bit of the way they put that moment together was gorgeous. But I think, thinking about it now, really the intimacy somehow of being in the theater and how much more powerful that was, you know, it's something that, I don't know, was, I don't know, just thinking about it now, just my movies are the thing.
Yeah. No, it's a powerful film.
Yeah.
And I'm not, it's funny. I'm not a sports guy, mm-hmm. but there are so many sports movies that I just love to death. I think my problem with sports generally is that there's almost never a good narrative. But in sports movies, you can have a great narrative.
It's, yeah,
you know.
That would be a whole other show, I guess.
Yes, it's also my fear is somebody wants to come in and talk about their favorite sports movies, and then we end up talking about sports for an hour. I just sit here. Like,
What else here? Let's see. Hit a lot of these. This is a movie I saw for the first time last year. Sonia Casti, who's on our show, recommended. Ken Loach is Kez.
Oh, God, yeah.
And huge area of ignorance. I had not seen any Ken Loach, which is a huge, this is the fun thing, is you can still see these things.
Yep.
Even if you missed
it's a lot easier now than it was when we were kids.
Yeah, a simple
boy and his hawk movie.
Yeah, yes. It has all, you know, it's a document of poverty in many ways. But it's a poor kid living in the north of England, has really nothing, and he finds and trains a kestrel. And there's just, that's the scene. And for whatever, and I kind of knew where it was going to end. I knew the fucking bird was going to die. And I'm sorry, spoiler, but the scene that actually kills me is when you meet this kid, he's like, I think the first scene that he's like sharing a bed with his brother, his older brother, he's like 10 and his brother is 16 and they're in like a tiny bed and it's cold and they're just, you just see the misery and claustrophobia of their lives. And then that's just repeated throughout, is you see like how small his life is, and this bird gives him this other place to go.
Yeah.
And he's not a good student. He's bullied. He was just kind of like a regular kid, really. Yeah. He's not like,
he's not a magical child.
Yeah, at all. And he just likes this bird.
Yeah.
And he finds something he's good at. And the scene that just killed me was at some point, it's probably about three quarters of the way through, he's in class and he's made to by the teacher to get up and talk about something. It's the thing he wants to do least in the world. And I forget exactly how it goes, but he's struggling to talk about whatever they were supposed to be talking about. And the teacher somehow, with a moment of humanity, like asks him another question, and the bird comes up and he says, "We'll talk about that." And so this kid who I don't know who this actor is, whether he ever did anything else, but again, a childhood performance, he just starts talking about the bird and it kind of just builds and you just feel the passion he has for it and the love. And it's what kills me is the moment where he's actually becoming himself. Like, this is his truest self, and his classmates kind of don't give a shit. The teacher can kind of see it, but he's happy and he's in his own little place and he's able to speak in front of the class because he's talking about what he's obsessed with and what he loves. And I don't know, for whatever reason, that I don't think I was in a full weep, but I definitely was like, that is what is a beautiful moment as I can remember seeing in movies, is this kid talking about this bird that he loves in a way that just felt so real, so not treacly in any way. It's just, it's a glorious moment. And you kind of know what's going to come after that, but that killed me.
It's funny. I think about what some of your influences may or may not be, or what the show reminds me of. And, cause there is also that sort of awareness of class that's obviously the forefront of what he does. Have you seen I, Daniel Blake, his last?
No, I was actually going to ask if you guys had other.
It's about a guy, an older retired guy in England who's just dealing with medical insurance problems. And it will just rip your heart out.
It's so seemingly banal because it's just these people who are ordinary people who are very poor and they have these problems. And this one guy has got a medical problem, got some money problems. And how quickly you get caught up in this world that you sort of reject out of hand is like, I don't want to be with these people. These people are miserable, you know? But yet there's something so noble about the movie that it really drags you in.
His good stuff always does that.
Is that Pete Postlewaite?
No.
Who was it? He'd been dead for years.
Who was the actor? It was one of those guys who's been in a million things. Dave Johns.
Yeah.
His name. Again, great character actor.
It's funny because I don't know. I can't say why Kez was so like hypnotic in a way. It's nothing, I'd say, too flashy filmmaking.
Yeah.
And he just knows what to put next to the next. I don't know. Like it really is. There's a humility to it that somehow, makes the world feel noble somehow in some way it's something else.
No, he's great at that somehow. He's great at, and it's not, you know, let's take away from someone like Fincher, who's this amazing technician and, you know, always the right shot, the right light. And but someone like Ken Loach clearly has mastered his own version of that.
Yeah.
It's just you don't notice because
as
you say, the films, so many of them, they feel like they're not fully scripted, that it's just the actors kind of, you know, rambling, and his camera sort of seems to have almost fallen where it is, but it works. It's the right shot. And it was a Jeremy Corbyn hired him to do his campaign ads when he was running last time, and they were very successful.
Right, and I did see one of them, and they were
amazing.
They were very effective.
Which makes you he should be getting more of those people to do that stuff. That's an incredible film.
Yeah. I don't know if there's any, who would you say maybe is it an American equivalent of Ken Loach? Is there anyone who?
I don't know. He's kind of Cassavetes like.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of a Cassavetes thing. Some little John Sayles.
Yeah, that's maybe. What I was thinking.
Yeah,
he's usually dealing with a little more higher concept or narrative punch and stuff.
Yeah.
But he, I think what he cares about is very simple.
Well, because he's a writer.
Yeah, but he makes Secret of Ronin Ish is a very Loach-like movie.
While being a kind of magical fan.
If
Ken Loach directed a fairy tale almost.
I
also, by the way, I just, we were talking about your show. It's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because it was such a lovely moment. I was like, did they ever use this phrase again? Or is it just on one? There's one episode where a character makes passing reference to her brain cloud. Do you want to talk about Joe versus the volcano for a minute? Or is that, was that an overt, or was it just?
Well, I will say that term came from Peter Ocko, who's our brilliant showrunner. I would say that it was him.
Because that's what Tom Hanks says in Joe versus the Volcano,
right,
which is a film that I'd never thought of in conjunction with Lodge until that, and I thought, oh, there's actually a kind of.
That's funny because I saw it when it came out, and it probably washed over me. I remember liking how strange it was, and. I forget what point in the writing or people talk, like a couple of you brought up Joe versus Volcano. So I went back and watched it and definitely appreciated how unusual it is. And
as in, how did this get made?
Yes, which is the ultimate quality, I think.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's kind of, I hadn't even thought about that. Like at the moment, you know, and I'm not a religious person and prone to this sort of thing, but the moment when he's on that raft And it's just life is just couldn't, you know, he's sunk in boat and everything's fucking horrible. And he's on a raft in the middle of the ocean at night with no food.
That's Castaway.
And no water. Yeah. And then, and there's that giant moon appears. And here's a guy who, like, you know, he's seconds away from starvation and death and sharks. Yeah. And he just bursts into tears and goes, thank you, God, for my life. I'm like, I lose it at that. It's such, it's so the right response. It's just, it's kind of,
That I will say what I remembered about that from the first time I watched it was starting to understand the difference between, like, why the way that it looked and the way the camera moved was important, which is like 13, like you're just, oh, it's just a movie. It's all one thing. And then you're like, I'm feeling this way. And this movie's, I'm remembering it because of the cinematic quality of it. So I do remember that. Like it always stayed with me visually in an important way. And I think, going back and seeing it, those types of things were like, oh, that's great.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. A little spotty, but I love that film.
Yeah.
But,
Can I ask, like, who directed that, actually?
John Shanley.
Oh, Shanley.
Okay.
The writer.
One of the writers turned directors who decided he'd rather be a writer.
but
considering what they put him through on that movie.
But also a writer turned director turned out to be really good at it, I think. I would argue Blatty, probably my favorite of those guys. Makes two perfect, incredibly directed films. Well, semi-perfect.
All right. Well, more of my
weepies.
Weepies. Best.
I just want to see Joe burst into tears.
All right. Here we go. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Again, a movie that I saw as a kid, enjoyed. It's great. I'm Steve Martin's using the F word. I'm totally in on. And then in my 20s, I saw it again, and like, is it John Hughes? I think it's my favorite John Hughes movie. I think I like a lot of his stuff, but like, there's no teenagers or kids.
Right.
It's an adult movie.
Yeah. No, I tend to prefer the ones without the kids.
And, it's very simple. And, the character who's been withholding a secret and when it's revealed, for whatever reason, at some point, I don't know. It just gets to me. It's a movie I see all the time. And I think maybe it's just John Candy, I guess, what a gift he was, and that he's just a ball of humanity. Like, I don't know.
There was always, even like on SCTV when he was playing just absolutely awful, irredeemable, even Harry, the guy with a snake on his face, there was always this weird gleam of humanity, brokenness and neediness.
He'll always be Johnny LaRue.
Johnny LaRue. Yeah. But you can't help but feel for Johnny. You want him to get his crane.
He was a really, he was a really nice guy.
Yeah.
Well, I never got to work with him, but I did meet him a couple of times.
Yeah.
He's really a sweet guy.
I don't know. It's just, I think something of Steve Martin, his iciness and just when the ice breaks, it's all, pretty straight down the line. And,
That's, I need to go because I saw that at the age where, first of all, I was not a fan of the John Hughes teen comedies and there was always this kind of resistance. I love Vacation. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting through Planes, Trains and going, okay, he's being really funny again. I'm loving this. And that ending, it was just, I was at that stage, I think you were talking about earlier, although I took longer to get out of it, I think, where I was almost angry at the ending. I was like, oh, come on, you had to go to that place. And I want to go back to the film. I'm also half afraid to go back to it because I have a feeling it will now shatter me.
I don't know. It's sappy as hell. Sure. And I don't know, maybe it's just our current, or the world we're living in now, where I think there's such a premium, when the people at the top were so fucking cruel that their whole worldview is cruel that this is the slightest glint of decency will just take me out. And I think maybe I'm not alone in that, that heightened sense of emotion. And
I think that's very well put. I think that's,
So I'm more forgiving of what I can see as my more intellectual 20s, this is just, manipulative.
Yeah. At least you're trying to manipulate me into something that's decent.
So positive. I would forgive it. But I think in the end, like the way the what buys it is simply is John Candy.
Yeah.
Just, you know. Yeah, well, John Candy. It's also it's a Thanksgiving. Are there any other Thanksgiving movies that surely the others?
But that's a Christmas. I was thinking Remember the Night, but that's a Christmas movie. It's Christmas that he takes her.
There's that parody. There's the one from Grindhouse, the trailer.
That came to mind.
No, Eli Roth. What was it? This Thanksgiving movie? Yeah. Was it Thanksgiving?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, it's not Don't.
Thanksgiving
it's,
Day.
It's Eli.
Yeah, that's Edgar Wright.
Yeah. I just picturing the grandmother trust on the table. Or, dear God.
There aren't a lot of Thanksgiving movies.
That's interesting. I don't know.
Yeah. So I'll probably,
there's a lot of cartoons about Thanksgiving.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
I'll probably throw that on.
Yeah.
The next week or so.
Yeah.
Let's see. The Devil's Backbone. Is this?
Really? Okay.
This is a movie. It's what's his name?
Guillermo.
Yeah, that guy is pretty.
Trailers from Hell Guru.
Yes.
Anyway, I guess it's I prefer it to Pan's Labyrinth. His kind of meditations on the Spanish Civil War, and it's a movie. First time I saw it, it really I couldn't stop thinking about it. And there's one moment in particular, but it's a genre bending weird chamber piece. It's orphans. It's set in an orphanage during the Spanish Civil War. It's a war movie, a coming of age movie, a ghost story, a thriller. You know, it's a love story. It's all these things. And I don't know how he pulled it off. And I think the main character who you kind of come in with, this young kid, he's a very kind of cool character. And he meets these kids, and one of the kids is a bully. The arc of the story is them kind of coming to an understanding with each other that they're all in the same boat, and with all the crazy stuff happening. It's weirdly this bully's moment that just like kind of broke my heart. Mm. And at some point you get a sense that there's a younger woman, he's like 12, and there's a girl's like maybe 19 or 20. She works at the orphanage and takes care of the kids. And you just have a sense all the kids are kind of in love with her in some way. Right. Just she's kind. She's the only person who cares about them, along with the two older people. But her boyfriend is kind of the bad guy in the tale, who's like the groundskeeper. And he's basically is going to end up betraying everybody. And there's a moment where everything's gone wrong and these kids are left to their own devices, where he just makes a gesture to the girl. He has this little, it's like a ring that goes on a cigar, mm-hmm. like a little
the paper
tin ring or something. Okay. She has to leave the orphanage to go do something. And you kind of have a sense that it's a mission to the going nowhere, that she's not going to come back. And he goes up to her and he gives her a ring. And for some reason, that whole thing, it was like a tiny short story in the midst of a crazy short story, but the smallness of it, whenever I watch it, I've watched it many times. It just fucking kills me. I don't know why. It's something about, an unlikable character just has this moment of grace, and the way the wisdom of the older girl, who knows that this young boy is in love with him, and she on some level I think feels it and is like there's a connection there, and on some other plane of existence these two are together because there's some bond there. So it just a magic romantic moment of two people who are never going to see each other again. So
I love those. You do a lot of it on the show. One thing I love is that you don't do it for all the characters, which is good, but you for way more than you would expect. You do give real humanity and moments of grace to characters who normally would be kind of unacceptable, reprehensible, sort of the bad guys, whether it's was it Liz's boss at the restaurant?
Yeah.
Constantly making reference to their affair that they never had, or stuff like that. But then every now and then you'll have a character like, I don't know, there's like her ex-boyfriend who's living with them for an episode or two, where it's like, I actually kind of appreciate that he never got that moment. You still have the occasional sort of schmuck. But it is that thing where you take characters who would normally be relegated to kind of bad guy status.
Yeah.
And dive deep into their humanity, which is always nice.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like my instincts are always are comic to begin with. And I think at some point I get in whatever is sad or emotional. I can only enter it through absurdity and comedy. And I think that's where Peter Ocko and I, we share that sensibility that we were fans of comedy. That's where
right.
I think comedy is, in my mind, I would say is, you know, it seems to be relegated under tragedy somehow. Yeah. I think they're equal. I consider them equals. But yeah, I think there are characters on the show that are a joy to write because they're pure comic characters. They're kind of mechanical in a certain sense. And that's a joy, but it's also fun to give those characters something else, that little thing, you know,
note of grace.
Daniel Sherman, who plays the character you're talking about, Jeremy, who's when we meet him, he's the manager of essentially like a Hooters-esque establishment, which I think it's the actor. Cause another actor, you would just feel the scumminess of it, but it's impossible with him. He's a man trying to make a living and he's in a scummy environment, but his heart somehow is good, even though he some of the things he says, he's a little unaware of, but that's the fun stuff to write.
No, it's lovely. I mean, so have you ever seen, Joe, we never talked about it on the show. I don't think I've been trying to find a trailer forever to do it on Trailers from Hell, Laiolo. Mm. You know, have you seen Laiolo, the French Canadian film, director? Oh God, he did one other film, I think. And then passed away, but it's this autobiographical movie about a kid growing up and wanting to be a writer that, I think you would love it. It has so many of those kind of elements of, it never quite launches into the magical, but at any moment angels could come drag him away and it flies off into sort of flights of fancy. He's convinced he's a French Canadian kid who's convinced he's Italian and he has this whole, and you actually see this, this thing happen is, he has this theory that, there's some Italian guy, and you see this guy working in the tomato fields who's in love with this woman who's bending over picking tomatoes, and this old Italian guy is like whacking off into the weeds. And then those tomatoes, which have been besmirched with his seed, shall we say, go to Canada, where Laiolo's mother trips and falls into them and is impregnated. And this is why he's convinced he's Italian. He keeps running around going, Laiolo, my name is Laiolo. And they're like, you're not Italian.
I will track that
down.
Yeah,
no, it's a wonderful, weird tangent. I'm sorry. But but carry on.
I've hit the ones that were on my mind. I don't know if this sparked anything.
Yeah, no, I mean, Joe, I'd love to, like, what kills you? What makes you bawl like a baby?
Oh, I'm pretty
easy.
I'm pretty easy. A really well done scene will make, I'll feel a tear coming out of the side of my, you know, a great performance, a great piece of music, a great, you know, I just, anything when it's done really well.
Yeah.
It's moving. You know, when it's just the quality, the fact that a quality like that can be attained. And sometimes it's just listening to music on headphones. I mean, you can leap. It's one of our better emotions. And I think a lot of people aren't quite as connected to it as they might be.
Yeah. It's funny. I was thinking of like ones that get me, and the two came to mind. I realized there's kind of a commonality to them. They're the scene in Tucker where, Martin Landau's on the stand and he's been revealed to be this con man and everything, but he really believed in Tucker and the lawyer is coming at him and he's like, do you think there's one man in this courtroom who would believe a word you'd say? And Martin Landau goes, yes, one. And he's looking at Jeff Bridges and it's like, oh God. And then the scene in Breaker Morant where the two guys, Brian Brown and God damn it, the Equalizer.
Ed Woodward.
Ed Woodward are walking off to be executed. And Ed Woodward has that great line at the end, shoot straight, you bastards, and don't make a mess of it, which, like, if I'm ever in that situation, I'm going to call on that one. but they walk off to be shot, these two Australian soldiers, these man's men, you know, and they're going off and it's like, it's all over. And there's just this little, and he doesn't, you know, he doesn't zoom in on it or anything. And it's like, yeah. It feels like something just the actors did. And the two guys just reach out and hold hands as they go off to die. And it's just like, oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
It's just such a human moment. But both of those are about kind of human connection and acknowledging it in the face of.
One of the great scenes like that is the end of Paths of Glory.
Oh.
Where, you know, you've watched this entire picture.
Yeah.
And you've seen these guys, you know, executed for
nothing.
Nothing. And then at the end of the movie, you think it's over. And Kirk Douglas has to go back and tell the men that they're going to go back out to the fields. And this woman comes out to sing. She's a French woman. And a German woman.
Yeah,
and,
German, yes.
And she starts to sing. And the guys are all hooting and they're drunk. And they're... Rah, rah, rah. And then the pure purity of her voice, they start to stop and they start to calm down and they start to look at her and then they start to cry.
Yeah.
And it's like you just can't watch the scene without crying.
Yeah.
And it's a culmination of everything else that's happened in the movie, which is a great movie. But a friend of mine who saw it said, well, you know, the reason he put all those end credits on the end where it identifies the actors is so people can wipe their eyes and they can leave the theater like they're crying.
That old softy.
Yeah, that old softy.
Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, how many Kubrick films do you think that?
The one just, yeah, I think music is a, like, the thing, Casablanca, I mean, the I remember the day when Trump got elected, I put on Casablanca.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to hear them sing that.
Yes.
Put on Schindler's List.
Jesus. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an amazing, oh my God, just the shots of the young girl singing with the tears streaming.
Well, we see it from this remove, but can you imagine how powerful that was?
Absolutely.
Yep. Oh, I said something. I saw this, read this recently about that a lot of the people who were actors were
actual refugees. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
refugees.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that what you're feeling there was all there. Like it was real. Like,
the watch couple. Aren't they? Yeah.
I think it's one of those things that that what they always talk about Casablanca is that all the things that went right to make this thing happened, and that was one of them, you know.
No, that's the quintessential everything that's wrong with Hollywood movie. You can point to, like, they should not have made movies like this.
Isn't that the one where
it works?
A number of years ago, they took the title off and changed it.
They went around the script.
Handed around the script to people in Hollywood, and they all
very
rejected
few.
It.
Oh, really? Yeah, there were like two people who knew what it was, but pretty much everyone else rejected. There were a ton of notes. Yeah, there was a great, did Spy do that? It was a while back. There was a great article about the responses they got and the notes and
metrics.
The metrics of this movie.
Yeah, I think, well, this isn't always the case with the ones I brought up, but I think the thing that tends to kill me now is scenes that are kind of doing what you're just saying, where it's just so well made, but oftentimes that doesn't always have to, but the restraint is something that is the thing that actually turns, you know, I feel the most is when a character is holding on and not giving you emotion and you have to take it on.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't have a good example of that, but I think it's kind of I notice that more and more. It's something that when I see that, I'm like, that's
what the artist is. It's terrifying to write and to shoot and everything because you're depending on it all working. So I understand the impulse to go, let's show more.
Yeah.
It's a safe way to play the scene. But
when
those scenes work and you're just looking at the face of some character who's not reacting to something.
Yeah.
That's heartbreaking.
I will say just personally, just to bring it back to Lodge 49, I think, you know, we've had, you know, in our absurd universe, we do have these moments where as someone who is so new to this, where I just felt like, you know, how have I ended up here? I get to be in this room watching these actors do this thing. There's a scene at the end of season one with Dud and Liz, Wyatt and Sonia that was just being there, like in the rehearsal, you're like, here we go. And the one, you know, there were a couple this year, but the scene you brought up at the beginning with Ernie and Dud.
Yeah.
I remember when we rehearsed it, you could hear like in the darkness and the shadows, people sniffling and crying off after her first rehearsal.
Yep.
And, you know, again, that's just the actors, you know, they showed up ready for it. And I think those two guys in that moment, I think that's where the kind of the restraint of Brent Jennings and Wyatt is what I think killed everybody.
Well, and also the fact, especially Wyatt, who's such a wacky character. I mean, I'm almost reminded of like Zonker Harris from Doonesbury, you know, when you've got someone who's had so many light moments and so much stuff kind of zeroing in like that.
Yeah.
It makes it more powerful.
Yeah. Fun stuff. So, I guess I've just been in an emotional state lately, guys. And
that's understandable.
I had to come in and,
Well, thank you for sharing it with us. Yeah, no, it's some wonderful films. And this hopefully by the time this drops, this solution, season three will be underway. We're probably, it's going to be a couple of weeks. Yeah. But I would just love to.
I think it means the world for me. You guys have me on.
Well, also, it seems like we also live in a time now where, first of all, we didn't used to, you know, it's like a show was gone, it was gone. You couldn't take it from ABC and sell it to somebody else. So there's more doors open. But it feels like, too, just with all the various kind of delivery systems, that sometimes it takes things longer.
Yeah.
I had forgotten it. So I was just thinking, like, Family Guy was sort of.
Exactly.
There was that whole thing where it was just the thing my friends knew about, and they swapped DVDs, and it got canceled after a year or something.
I think the trick here, though, is that you've got actors under contract, and, you know, once the ensemble breaks up and people go off to shows and stuff, it's like, well, now how are we going to put them back together? Yeah. So it's really a window.
Yeah.
It is. We're feeling it. Yeah. You know, I think all I can say is that we're very proud of what we made. And I whatever happens, I know people are going to keep finding the show, and that makes me happy. And
That's the great thing. As I said, I just want to stress it, because sometimes there's that thing of like, well, it's not going to end. I shouldn't. It's like, it is. You can walk out at the end of the second season and you want more, but you're not wondering, you know, who shot JR? It's an absolutely wonderful show. It's a thrill to have you here. And thank you for coming in and making us all cry.
Thank you, John.
Our show was recorded in beautiful downtown Burbank. The official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.